Today's Keisho will be on Case 17 in the Book of Serenity, Phaon's Hair's Breadth. Introduction. A pair of solitary wild geese flap on the ground and fly up high. A couple of mandarin ducks stand alone by the bank of the pond. Leaving aside for the moment the meeting of arrow points, what about when a saw cuts a scale beam? Case. Phaon asked Zhui Shan, a hair's breadth of difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. How do you understand this? Zhui Shan said, a hair's breadth of difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. Phaon said, how can you get it that way? Zhui Shan said, I am just thus. What about you? Phaon said, a hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. Zhui Shan thereupon bowed. Verse. When a fly sits on the scale, it tilts. The balance scale of myriad ages shows up unevenness. Pounds, ounces, grams, and grains. You see them clearly, but after all, it finally reverts and gives up to my zero point. Well, today is the first of our 7 days of practice together, and I just want to say again, as I did last night, how wonderful it is to be here practicing with all of you. Some of you have been, in some cases, we have been practicing together for years and years, more than a decade. In some cases more recently, but it's just wonderful to see you all here and to practice with you. This morning, the sitting in the Zendo was thunderously quiet, just beautiful sitting. It's a true honor to practice with you. And I have to say that, in my opinion, it doesn't get any better than this. You know, life doesn't really get any better than this. This is sort of my personal idea of heaven. We got up early this morning. We sat down. We recited the sutras, beautiful sutras, together. By the way, there's a gentleman who's been coming to sit with us on Monday night. I'm sure some of you have noticed him. He's the Quaker chaplain on campus. And he just loves practicing Zazen. He has a very hard time because he's rather elderly and he has rheumatoid arthritis, I believe, or I think it is rheumatoid. So his body's very stiff, and he struggles a lot. You know, I offered him the opportunity to sit in a chair, but he really wants to do it right. So he sits on the ground and has a lot of discomfort and moves a fair amount, but he's getting quite a bit out of it. When he told me what's happening in his sits, he really is entering samadhi sometimes. But anyway, he came to the Saturday sit the day before yesterday. And he said, he came up to me after the Saturday sit and he said, what's with those sutras? And I thought he was going to complain because believe it or not, you know, over the years, people have come up and said, you know, what are those sutras? What is that all about? And some people have even said, you really should translate them into English. You should recite them in English, which is the national language. And I said, people say that to me, and I just say, well, you know, and I sort of let my voice trail off and so on. But this gentleman, Quaker chaplain, he came up and said, what's with the sutras? And I was sort of bracing for him to say, you need to put them in English. And instead he said, so beautiful. And I just, I wanted to just give him a big hug. Because sutras really are beautiful, I think. You know, at 4:30 in the morning, if you're really tired, it may be a little hard to keep up, and it may be a little hard to have to recite the sutras with open heart. But they're really very beautiful, aren't they? English is the national language, I guess, or going to be. But the sutras are in another language, which is like the language of Murshin. Right? The beauty of the sutras is that even the Japanese people who sit down and recite these sutras have no idea consciously what they mean. Except Hakuin Zenji, Zazen Wasan, which we just recited, it's very difficult for Japanese people to understand. It sort of hovers on the edge of understanding between conscious and unconscious mind. And so it's better than the national language. It's like a primordial language. Before there was any language, there was this language. This is the language of the sutras. It's not Hindi, not Sanskrit, not Chinese, not Japanese. Before all of those languages, this is like original speech. So it's so beautiful to get up in the morning together, the 11 of us this morning, and recite the sutras. And then have tea, and then sit down and do our zazen, and all the birds, still, they're serenading us outside. Just, this is like heaven. This is my idea of heaven. This is just so wonderful. And then we had breakfast. And of course, oatmeal is always delicious, right? Every grain, you can taste every grain. It's just like heavenly nectar, right? And the fruit. This is just like perfection. Everything is perfect. So there's really no problem in a certain way. You know, we come here to wake up, we say, and that's true. It's true. But this is like awakened life itself. This is awakened life itself. So what we're really trying to do is just notice that fact. You know, it's not one way to think about Zen practice is that there's this tremendous obstacle, and it's all of this karma, and that's true. You know, there's all of this karma. We have years and years of selfishness, anger, and delusion to overcome. And it's like shoveling a huge pile of dirt, right? And I think, sit down on the cushion and start shoveling away. You know? That's definitely an element of practice. It's definitely true. Sometimes it's just hard work sitting on a cushion. But you know, the truth is, the other way to look at the practice is to realize that already enlightened. Just allowing natural self to emerge. I love the poem here When a fly sits on the balance, it tilts, right? The balance scale of myriad ages shows up unevenness. Pounds, ounces, grams and grains, you see them clearly, but after it's all over, the scale goes back to the zero point. I just think that's so true. And all we're trying to do is let the scale go back to the zero point. And all of this fuss, all of these worries that fill up our lives, all of these concerns, all the years go by and we're getting older and we think, what have I done with my life? Or what am I going to do with my life? Or will I be someone? You know, all of these efforts are like stirring up dust, right? It's just like stirring up dust on a dusty road. But if you stand still for a moment, the dust begins to settle and you can see the light coming through the leaves of the trees. You know, that's really sort of what sesshin can be. It is true that we can't always find that state of mind. You know, we come to sesshin sometimes with real sense of desperation. I have to tell you the truth that when I started practicing Zen, I really was like a man on fire. I don't mean a fire with the desire to wake up. I mean, I was on fire because my life just seemed to be so difficult to live. I had many problems in my life. Some of them were psychological problems caused by my upbringing and my personal decisions. And some of them were related to my circumstances. But for some reason, I was not very happy. And I felt constantly on edge and unsafe. And I've talked about some of the circumstances that produced that feeling, you know. I was going to graduate school and I wasn't a very brilliant graduate student. I didn't really have any other options besides graduate school because I'd had a number of jobs that were, not very satisfying. And I hadn't been tremendously successful at those jobs. And so I probably thought I had nowhere else to go but the cushion. And so when I practiced, it was with a real sense of urgency, like I was on fire. And I had these deep-seated anxieties about life. Really, real tension. You know? And it took me many years of practice. And a lot of people practice that way. In fact, maybe most people practice that way. And so when you come to sesshin, you may have this you might bring all this anxiety with you, you know. Maybe you have a job that's very tense. You know, some of you have jobs I know that are very demanding and difficult and frustrating. I know that. And I'm really glad you're here. And it may be a little while before you can liberate yourself from that mindset. And it usually takes a few days, actually, before the mind becomes calm and clear enough to return to its natural state, to the zero on the scale. For the first couple of days, we're sort of adding a little on this side and taking away a little on this side and trying to get it right. And actually, that's sort of necessary, but it may not be the best way to practice. You know, on Saturday, I was talking about this article that just appeared in Science magazine. And some of you were at the Saturday sit, but many of you weren't. So let me just mention that in the most recent Science magazine, there was an article on attention and making decisions. And a psychologist was basically examining two groups of people and their decision-making process. And basically, one group of people we're very focused on a problem and a solution. And so, for example, in one of the experiments, these people were asked to pick a, I think it was like a living room that they would like. I want you to decide which of these living rooms you like. And they were allowed time to deliberate consciously, carefully, and mull it over in their minds and make a decision. And then, after they'd made a decision, later they were asked to evaluate their, after they had a chance to look again at the living room they chose, how did they feel about it? And a fair number of them weren't very happy with the decision they had made. I think that's very interesting. In other words, they were focused, they were determined, they applied reason and attention, and basically came up with an answer, and then later didn't like the answer that much, some of them. Fairly high percentage. And this article really ties in with some other things I've read. A lot of psychologists have been doing research on happiness and asking people to predict what events in their lives would make them happy. And one of the stunning facts from this research is that people are very bad at predicting what will make themselves happy. Isn't that interesting? That they'll ask people, well, what would make you happy? And then they'll follow up and find that they did indeed get whatever. And that when they get it, they're not any happier. And I just think that's fascinating. So this study was very narrowly focused on a decision-making process. And the important thing was that this one group was able to focus, you know, use willpower, use reason, pursue an answer, and come up with an answer, and then assess their answer. And they were not very happy, a lot of them, with their result. Then there was this other group, and there were a number of experiments that this article described, but I may not be getting it exactly right, but for the purposes of this discussion, the second group wasn't allowed to go through that process. They were distracted in the decision-making process. So they were asked to make a choice, and then some distractions were introduced so that they couldn't really be focused. And then they made a choice, and it strangely, when they came back and reviewed their decision, they were happier with the results. And the researchers said there's a kind of awareness which is not a directly attentive. It's not focused awareness. And that actually it seems to produce better results, more positive decisions. And as I say, this ties in with a lot of research about people's life decisions, because it seems to be the case that when people say, okay, what I want is to be president of the company by the time I'm 45, and then they get to be 45, a fair number of people are not any happier, or even they're even unhappy. And the interesting thing is that people are very bad at predicting what will make them happy. And they're very bad at making decisions using focused, attentive, reasoned mind. And I just think that's stunningly important. Because what we're doing is trying to cultivate or letting arise in us a different kind of concentration, different kind of attentiveness. We're sort of, I can't remember right now the term that the researchers used, but I wasn't totally happy with it. It was something without attention. But I'm not exactly happy with that. I don't know what we could call what we're doing, but it's more like, I would like to call it attention without object. Maybe that's another way to put it. It's like attention without object. So it's like bare attentiveness. So it's not as though we're attending to anything in particular. We're just attending. It's just awareness, mindfulness, without any particular object. And even when we're trying to answer our koan, this is sort of the mindset, sort of the state of mind we have to cultivate. It's kind of a mind that rests nowhere. In fact, in classical Chan texts, this is actually how they describe it, as a nowhere abiding mind, or a mind that stops nowhere. The mind doesn't rest at any particular object of attention. It's just moving from moment to moment to moment to moment. And in classical Zen training, koans are often designed to stop the ambient, that mind that's sort of ambling along, that ambient mind, and arrest it until it can break free again and go forward. So koans sometimes sort of trick you into getting stuck. But the way to process your koan, no matter what it is to let the big mind do the work. See? Is let the big mind do the work. This is quite important. You know, even people who don't practice Zen sometimes approach problems in this way. After the Saturday sit, there was a person who came up to me and said, you know, he's just started sitting with our group. He came up to me and he said, you know, when I have problems like this, when I have problems, I sort of solve them like this. I go for a bicycle ride, or I go away for the weekend, and then the answer comes to me. I'll be stuck. I think he's a physicist, as a matter of fact. And he said, I'll be stuck with a problem, and then I can't solve it, and I'll just go out away for the weekend, or I'll go for a hike. And while I'm doing that, the answer will come to me. And this is a common practice that some people, Hughes, have developed. You know. It's like you're looking for the answer, but you try not to look too hard. You know, I mean, when I've said that in the past, and I think to say try but don't try, it seems like a Zen koan in itself, but it's really not. There's a real method to this, and it's letting the mind be attentive without fixing on anything in particular. And you're sort of at the back of your mind, you're returning periodically to the koan. So a lot of the work that goes on the cushion may not seem directly related to the koan, right? I mean, you don't want to let your mind just wander in thought and so on, but you know, you're focusing on the breath, you're focusing on mu, you're focusing on your koan, and then, you know, you hear the birds singing, memories pop up in your head, and so on and so on, and you realize your leg hurts, and you think about lunch, and you come back to your koan, and you know, there's a way of practicing, which is this attentiveness without object. It's like going to your goal by an indirect route. And this is really quite effective. I mean, I think this is really the essence of Zen practice. You know, the conscious mind is just anchored, anchored isn't the right word. It's the conscious mind is just following the moment from moment to moment. It's almost like drifting along. And the big mind, which the conscious mind, the little mind can't see, is like processing the koan. And it's looking for the answer. See, just like that guy who's trying to do physics and he goes for a hike. Somehow, while he goes for a hike or takes a nap, the big computer is looking for the answer. You know? But a little mind can't do it. So little mind just has to stay in a kind of receptive, open state. It's like just going with the, you know, we say going with the flow. And that's what the mind has to do. Just go with the flow. So the little mind's just trying to be attentive without any particular object. And that's all it has to do. Not get stuck anywhere and start thinking. See, once the mind starts grasping something and holding tight, see, then you're sort of you're blocking. So you know, basically, as you're sitting, something might come up, some worry at work, or even like anxiety about not answering your koan, and you can just keep returning to this like it's a math problem that you're trying to solve. And generally, this just arrests the process. You know, so good Zen practice is sort of this indirectness. You know, it's a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever read this book, Zen and the Art of Archery, but quite a few people have read this book and liked it a great deal. I myself was never a big fan of that book, although it's a perfectly good book. I just never really got into it. But somebody came up to me the other day and just said he had just read this book and just, I can't remember who it was, but just loved it. And I said, well, that's wonderful. But as I recall, and it's probably been 30 years since I read it, you know, the one way to do archery is to focus intensely on the bullseye, you know. So you look at the bullseye and you're really trying to hit it. And you focus all of your willpower and your attentiveness on the bullseye. That's one way to practice archery. But another way to practice archery is not to look just at the target, but to try to see the whole thing. It's like you try to be aware of the whole field of vision, the whole field of vision. You know, and so you're not consciously aiming. You're just trying to consciously be aware of the whole field of vision. And then you let the arrow go. And this is a very different approach, but I think the second approach is much closer to what we're doing in Zen practice. And this works in terms of answering koans. It works in other ways as well. You know, so, for example, in people's practice, in the course of their development as Zen people, it often happens, maybe after a couple of years, that when you're concentrating, noises are very troubling. There's a stage in your practice where it's just like noises are extremely annoying. You know? And I know this because, you know, they work for me too. And then after that, you know, they just don't bother you anymore. It's an interesting thing. It's like at some point, noises are just very troubling. And then they just stop in trouble. And I think what happens is that at a certain point in your development, you begin to develop an intense, focused concentration. So at first the mind is unable to focus for any length of time. And then as you practice working on your breath perception, you begin to be able to hold the mind steady on an object of attention for, say, 4 or 5 seconds over and over again for a little while till your mind gets tired. And that's when I think, generally speaking, noises can be very annoying. But I think later you learn how not to, you learn how to have a focused mind, but to let it go from moment to moment, sort of like letting it drift. And then, you know, you hear the sound of the motorcycle revving, but instead of fixing your mind on the sound of the motorcycle, you hear the motorcycle, but you also hear the birds, you hear the white noise of the traffic, you hear the wind, so you hear the crickets. So it's like when you just isolate your mind on the sound of the motorcycle, could be a little annoying, right? But when you sort of step back from that sound and you take in the whole field of hearing, then the motorcycle sound becomes like one little feature in a complex mandala, right? This is what a mandala is. It's like a field of consciousness. And so mandala in Tibetan Buddhism is a representation of kind of consciousness which doesn't alight on anything, which just sort of takes in the whole field. So, you know, you've got everything in some of these mandalas. You've got the town, you've got somebody killing somebody in the town, you've got somebody drinking, you know, and then you've got the hills, and you've got the temple on the hill, and there's the yogi next to the temple, and in his mind there's an image of Buddha. So you get the whole picture. You get the person who's achieving enlightenment and the person who's achieving a hell mind, all in one big picture. And the clouds are blowing overhead, and it's all one big thing. It's all one life. And the mandala is saying, don't focus on any particular thing, just let the consciousness take in the whole field. And this is really very much what Zen practice is about, or one way to approach Zen practice. It's just the case that people who come to Sesshin have objectives, of course. And we want to wake up, we want to achieve Kensho, Dai Kensho. And it's important to make an effort. It's important. If you don't try, nothing is going to happen. But trying in the right way is quite important also. Generally speaking, I think, people make really great progress in Zen if they apply themselves with diligence and they give up any expectations of result. So this is like the best thing that can happen. So in my own case, I really desperately needed to practice Zen because I was so unhappy and I was in a lot of psychological pain. And I started practicing Zen, and my real goal was not enlightenment, it was just getting out of pain. Then after a while I began to have a serious desire to be enlightened, to be Zen master, blah blah blah. And that really ruined everything for a long time for me. But the good part of it was that I really started practicing seriously. You know, I really made a serious effort. I actually started getting up at like 4 in the morning, which was a total break with my way of life, and driving down with my friends to a Kugeon city in the morning. And then I went through a long period of frustration because I wasn't able to answer my koan. But finally, you know, I just gave up. I was sort of trapped by then in Zen practice. I had almost all my friends were in Zen, and basically I had made a habit out of being a Zen student, and I just sort of gave up. I didn't know when I would accomplish anything in Zen. I would just keep practicing, and that's when really wonderful things began to happen to me. And I stopped counting the sesshins, and I stopped counting the years. And I didn't know what was going on at that point. And that's the ideal state. You know, I didn't have an opinion about my sesshins. I didn't have an opinion about my practice. It was just this ambient consciousness. You know, when I practiced, I was in this ambient consciousness. You know, sometimes you're sick on the cushion, sometimes you're healthy. Sometimes your legs hurt, sometimes they don't. These are all just pieces of the mandala, right? You know, and in Zen, beginning you have to learn to focus, but after you focus, you let the mind abide nowhere. It's just there's this moment and it brings whatever. And there's this moment and it brings whatever. And there's this moment and it brings whatever. And all the time you're still going back to the koan. You're still going back, you know, periodically you're going hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, or what does Buddha lie? What does Buddha, whatever your koan happens to be. But it's like you're activating the big mind and you're also using a little mind in a way that won't block it. You know, so if little mind becomes too concerned about answering the koan, it starts trying to figure it out. And when it fails, all this stuff kicks in, right? Oh, I'll never pass my koan. I'll never be any good. And what am I doing here? Blah, blah, blah. You know, we all listen to that voice too much, right? You're here. It's wonderful. So, you know, just don't listen to the little mind too much. Just keep coming back to the moment and a beautiful morning. It's going to be a hot day today. Maybe you'll be hot. You know? When you're hot, it's wonderful. When you're cold, it's wonderful. You know, just all pieces of the mandala. So the mind just travels through moment, 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 moment. Keep coming back to the koan and something is going to percolate down underneath. Yeah? Very important. Feiyan asked Zhuishan, a hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. This is like the Xin Xin Min, by Seng Zhang, right? If you make any kind of distinction, it sets heaven and earth apart. So Feiyan said to Zhuishan, a hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. This is really a quote from Seng Zhang. So this is a little different translation. He says, how do you understand that? Zhuishan said, a hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. So it's just, you know, he's not going to offer an interpretation. You know, he's being invited to offer an explanation or an interpretation. So this is like a test of his awareness. And his mind, he's not going to let his mind get stuck. He's just, you know, just what you just said is what you just said. So how can you have it this way? It's the moment. It's the moment. I'm not going to ask why. I'm not going to try to figure it out. I'm just going to be in the moment, whatever the moment happens to be. And that's a beautiful answer. Right? How can you get away with that kind of an answer? And so Zhuishan says, it's just the way it is, just the way it is right now. You ask the question is all my mind is aware of. So this is a beautiful, beautiful explanation of attention without object, the nowhere alighting mind, or the no stopping mind. So you just go from moment to moment to moment, and it's in the back of your mind, so to speak, there's the koan. And you're just sort of looking. You know those wonderful puzzles, maybe they don't even exist anymore. The other day I was talking in a Teshuva about a record, and I realized records don't exist anymore. But when I was growing up, there used to be a kind of a puzzle called Where's Waldo? I don't know if they still exist. But there was a picture of Waldo in a scene. It might be like a jungle or a desert. And it was like a complex drawing, right? Complex drawing. And in the drawing somewhere is the figure you're looking for. But when you look at first you don't see it. And the more you try to see it, the more frustrated you become. This is just, this is a classic, right? You just have to sort of let your mind play across the surface of the puzzle, and all of a sudden, boom, Waldo pops out at you. Yeah. There he is. There's Waldo. So this is just like Zen practice. It's like if you're trying too hard, if you don't try at all, nothing will happen. But if your mind is too tightly focused, see, you're not going to see Waldo in the puzzle. So the proper spirit is to periodically come back to your koan, just to come back to it. It's just like throwing the koan back into the unconscious, right? It's like tossing it back in periodically. And then just the tension is just on moment, this part of the mandala, this part of the mandala, this part of the mandala, this part of the mandala. Little by little, it's like sooner or later you just wander into it. It's just like wandering into it's just about finding the center, which is always where you are, but you know, the mind wanders all over until you find it. So you know, I'm just can't tell you how glad I am that we're all still alive and we're all together on this beautiful day, practicing in this heavenly realm. It's just marvelous. And we have 7 days ahead of us, wonderful, precious days. Let's live in the big mind. Let's enjoy this beautiful Zen life together.